Welcome to Bloomberg Law for this Tuesday, March 29th. I'm June Grosso. The Supreme Court deadlocked in one of the most high-profile cases of the term. The 4-4 ruling is a victory for unions in a case which could have affected as many as 5 million public sector workers. Bloomberg Law is brought to you by Columbia University's Executive Technology Management Graduate Program, which prepares technology professionals to drive business performance. Information at sps.columbia.edu/tech. Public sector unions survived the most serious challenge to their power in decades today after the Supreme Court deadlocked 4-4. The case involves some California teachers who opposed having to pay fees to cover the teachers' union's collective bargaining costs, saying their First Amendment rights were being violated. The tie allows more than 20 states to continue to require public sector workers to help fund the unions that represent them. The court's one-sentence order didn't give any reasoning or indicate how the justices voted, but during the arguments in January, it was fairly clear that the liberal justices supported the union's position and the conservative justices opposed it.
Many teachers think that they are devoted to the future of America, to the future of our young people, and that the union is equally devoted to that, but that the union is absolutely wrong in some of its positions.
The general has been saying is we have to leave it to each state to decide, because with this kind of agency fee, there are things that unions can do that we would choose not to do. The unions in California do teacher training.
That was Justice Anthony Kennedy and Justice Sonia Sotomayor. The death of Justice Antonin Scalia left the conservatives without that fifth vote to overturn precedent. My guests are Professor Stephen Sanders of the Indiana Morris School of Law and Professor Michael Selmy of George Washington University Law School. Steve, briefly explain the legal issue here.
Sure, Jim. The question here was whether states may require members of public sector unions, such as a teachers' union, to pay an agency fee or a fair share fee to defray the costs of the work that the union does to represent them, to do the bargaining and the negotiating that affects the working conditions of all teachers. The Supreme Court had previously said that teachers who oppose the political activities of a union cannot be forced to subsidize those. And so these teachers were not being forced to have their fees go towards, say, contributions to Democratic political candidates or lobbying on particular issues, but they were charged a fee to defray the costs to the union of actually doing the bargaining and the negotiating on working conditions. That is the whole point of collective bargaining. That's why we have unions. The teachers in this case were saying we shouldn't even have to pay for that, that it's essentially impossible to draw a distinction between political activities and conditions and law and negotiating and bargaining affecting the conditions of work. The teachers' unions and the state took a position that that is a defensible distinction.
Now, Michael, this was called a do-or-die case for unions by some legal analyst. Was it that important?
It was certainly that important in the context of public employees and the states where these agency fees are allowed. And I think unions have been struggling for years, but public employee unions have actually been doing quite well in many locations. About 35% of public employees are unionized, compared to only 7% of the private workforce. So this was seen as an important case for holding on to those members. And it wasn't clear how many of the public employees who currently pay the agency fees would have stopped paying if the court had come out differently, but the unions were certainly concerned about the effect on their coffers if the case had come out differently.
Steve, why were the conservatives seemingly anxious to overturn this 40-year-old precedent?
I'm not sure that it's technically correct to say they would have been overturning precedent, but they would have extended a rule that only extended so far in a precedent. Anyway, I think depending on your attitude toward the conservative justices, it's possible to look at this two ways. This is generally a court, including the conservative justices, who've been very, very strong on the First Amendment, who they view political contributions as speech, but even in other traditional a speech and expressive context, this is generally a court that's very strong in the First Amendment. Well, this was a First Amendment case. Essentially, what these teachers, the plaintiffs, were saying is it violates their First Amendment rights. It compels them to support speech-related activities that they don't support to make them pay this agency fee. The more cynical view, if you want to indulge that, is to say that the conservative inclinations of some of these justices run against the power that public sector unions have, and that this case, had it come out 5-4 against the schools in favor of the teacher plaintiffs, would have significantly weakened the power generally that public sector unions have in our not only in the workplace, but in our political life.
Michael, 30 seconds. Was it clear from the arguments that it would have been a 5-4 split if Justice Scalia had lived?
That's a question I can answer in the 30 seconds. Yes. I think it was very clear that this case would have been a 5-4 decision in favor of the plaintiffs and against the agency fees.
Today's Supreme Court deadlock in one of the highest-profile cases of the term allowed public employee unions to survive the biggest legal attack on them in decades. It also highlighted the stakes for filling the seat left open by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia on the same day that President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Federal Appeals Court Judge Merrick Garland, was on Capitol Hill meeting for the first time with a Republican senator. Illinois Senator Mark Kirk tweeted a photo of the meeting and urged his colleagues to meet with Garland. Democratic Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland also met with Garland and joined the chorus of Democrats calling for the Republicans to give him a confirmation hearing and a vote.
There's 9 months left in this year to suggest that we don't have the time and the president doesn't have the authority to appoint. It's just absolutely outrageous.
Republicans, led by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, insist that Obama, the successor, should fill the Supreme Court vacancy after American voters have a say in November. I've been talking with Professor Stephen Sanders of the Indiana Morris School of Law and Professor Michael Selmy of George Washington University Law School. Michael, the problem with having only 8 justices is going to be playing out at least until June. Will it have an effect on Merrick Garland getting a hearing?
It may. I think today's case is an example or sends a signal that the Supreme Court may not be expecting him to join the court early next term, because one option the court had but declined to use today was to hold the case over. They could have held it over for next term, set up a re-argument and the like, but the fact that they simply issued the one-sentence decision noting that they were tied may be a sign that they're not expecting them to be hearing. It also might be a signal to Congress that they really need to get him on the court. So you could read it either way in that. But I think we're going to see more of these decisions. And the step that they took in the other case, today, the contraception case, seeking the parties to compromise, is highly extraordinary.
And what's your opinion, Steve?
I think we have to assume that these cases are not a surprise. Ever since Justice Scalia's death, legal commentators have been speculating and handicapping sort of what cases are likely to result in 4-4 ties and what the consequences would be for both sides. So, Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans have very good legal analysts. They read the same blogs and newspapers as the rest of us, and so I guess we have to assume that they've made the calculation that there may be some short-term sacrifices, that is, cases that are aligned with their interests, such as weakening the power of public sector unions or protecting the religious liberty of nonprofit organizations. There may be some sacrifices along the way in decisions that would have gone their way, but that it's more important to fight the long battle and to get a justice that they would like to see if the election goes their way in November.
And Michael, this will basically be only until June that you're going to see these kind of decisions coming down. So during the, you know, the home stretch, it's just going to be hearings.
Yes, and it's hard to know exactly how many of these four decisions they'll have. No doubt the court will try to find some compromise in their own ways so that they can reach a 5-3 or some similar decision, and those are likely to be more narrow cases. But it may continue through next year. If Judge Garland does not get a hearing, then it could be all of next year, the whole term next year, where they only have eight members, because the next president would not really be able to nominate somebody and have them appointed before the end of next term.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as, Stephen, the fact that they didn't say we'll have a rehearing, they came out with the 4-4. In this case, the attorneys for the religious group say that he said that he's going to file a motion for a rehearing. What is the likelihood, considering the numbers, that that would be granted?
It seems unlikely, because a rehearing petition would take 5 votes, and it looks as though there would not be 5 votes for the proposition that this case should go forward, or that there was some error in simply letting the lower court decision stand. I think more likely is sooner or later this issue will come back to the court. That the same litigators, the same organizations that have been involved in this case, will find another agency fee, public employee case. They'll lose at the lower courts because of what the established law is, and they'll get to the Supreme Court once we have 9 members. But I think the Supreme Court can't put off every case that's a potential 4-4 split, because it would have an increasing backlog of cases that even if a new justice comes on board, that justice is not going to cast votes in cases where he or she did not sit and hear oral argument. So I agree with Michael that this is a problem that really goes beyond June, probably. And if the Senate is good for its word that it's not going to do anything during the lame duck session, we're looking at potentially next March or April before a new justice would join the court. In other words, going through almost a whole term with 8 justices.
And Michael, though they might have to take some cases, will the court be reluctant to take up some really controversial issues, because their split seems to be becoming more and more defined? Justice Kennedy, during the contraception hearings over Obamacare, seemed to be more on the conservative side than he usually is.
I think it's certainly possible that some cases that they would ordinarily would have taken if there had been 9 members, particularly if there had been 5 on the conservative side, will not be taken now. You know, if you look at these 4-4 splits with all the briefing and the arguments, it really turns out to be kind of a waste of everybody's time, because they're just affirming the lower court decision through lots of activity. And if they see, you know, potential cases being deadlocked that way, I think they're more likely to avoid taking them than trying to resolve them.
In this case, Steve, where it affirms the Ninth Circuit decision, is it, though it's not precedential, is it the same law throughout the country? Are there any circuits that disagreed with the Ninth Circuit?
I don't believe there are. Well, no, because I think all what the Ninth Circuit did was essentially believe that it was faithfully applying the framework the Supreme Court had provided many years ago, that is, money for express political activities bad, that is a First Amendment violation, money for union for direct workplace-related activities, that's okay. So far as I know, there is no circuit split. This is a situation where the laws that the lower courts are obligated to apply seems clear, and so it's a case where the plaintiffs essentially go through the motions of losing at the lower courts so they can get to the Supreme Court and encourage the Supreme Court to make new law.
Is this the strongest sign yet, Michael, that the court's conservatives can't muster a majority to rule in their favor, that it's really become, you know, liberal conservative?
Oh, it seems it. The the conservative wing of the court gets a lot of attention, but it's also the case that the liberal wing of the court, the 4 liberal members, vote together quite regularly and are a strong bloc on these important cases. And it's highly unlikely that one of them will move over. I think it's more likely that one of the conservatives might join in with the liberals on some issues, because that's happened more frequently, where Justice Kennedy or Chief Justice Roberts might align themselves with them. But the liberals are likely to stay where they are, which will mean that these controversial cases, and it's about a quarter of their docket, end up being 5-4 decisions, and that most of those decisions are, you know, could end up being 4-4 ties.
Finally, I'll have let you have the last word, Steve. As far as Merrick Garland, will he be a centrist if he gets on the court? Will he break these ties, or will he break these ties toward the liberal end?
Well, I think the idea of being a centrist is it means almost by definition you're less predictable. But from every analysis that we've seen, from the analysis of his jurisprudence, it seems as though he would be a centrist to moderate liberal. In other words, he would not be the median justice in the way that Justice Kennedy is so often, or that Justice O'Connor was. In this case, I think most people would predict that a Justice Garland would have probably voted with the liberals. It's a criminal justice matters, for example, where he's had a more conservative tendency.
I'm so sorry. We've come to the end of the show so quickly, it seems. Thank you, Professor Stephen Sanders of the Indiana Morris School of Law and Professor Michael Selmy of George Washington University Law School for being on Bloomberg Law. Thanks to our technical director, Reginald Bazile, and our producer, David Sutcherman. With All Due Respect is next for our Washington, D.C. audience. Bloomberg Best is next for our listeners in New York, Boston, and San Francisco right here on Bloomberg Radio. Please join us again tomorrow on Bloomberg Law here on Bloomberg Radio, and have a great evening.